Should we start off first talking about that, or then, or talking about WACMA and how people started to get involved in politics on behalf of people in the region?
Well, I think that's a good point, because it was things like that that people start taking an initiative, right? And they got an opportunity to take initiative to instead of being just the cannery basically saying what they got, people started taking initiative, and that sort of made people more proactive about lots of other things.
So maybe should we start off with that and then come back to how that influenced?
Well, that could be part of it, the whole app.
Yeah. Well, jump in. Feel free to jump in. Anyone. Just don't let me run the show. Ofi, continue your earlier conversation about the ownership of boats.
Well, the ownership of boats, I think, after the Bay voted to get power, I think shaped many of us. You could buy a conversion. A conversion is a sailboat with a 40 or 60 horse engine in it that the canneries converted, and they sold them for about $2,000. You had to sign a 5-year contract with them. That's all they wanted, $400 a year, I guess it was, and everything else that come with insurance and stuff like that. But it wasn't too bad. And they had another policy: if you want to finance a boat, you had to put, I think it was 30 or 1/3 down on a new Bryant or a commercial wood boat. Back then, they were building a lot of them wood boats in Seattle. And they were about $8,000 landed here, come up on Alaska Steam. And the canneries required 1/3 down, and I think the next summer when your boat came, you were going to pay 20%, and maybe 20% for until the boat was paid off. And that worked out pretty good. But we had a local organization that organized here back in the early 50s, Tunawak. Tunawak stands for Togiak Nushigak. They borrowed, the local, several people got together. They borrowed money from the BIA. They built some boats. The boats went to their members, and you had so many years to pay for it. That was a pretty good idea, but the cannery saw that as a flag, you know. If you get everybody, especially the native fishermen, you had to be a resident of Dillingham or Togiak to qualify. If they're going to see where all the natives go to Tunawak and get a boat, I mean, it's a loss of cannery control.
So
at Tunawak, I bought my first boat from them, and it worked pretty good.
And you said it really shaped your perspectives and how so?
Yeah, because you had something to work for, I guess, you know, years. Well, I never did, but my father fished for the cannery where everything is furnished. But you had to produce fish, too. And when I signed my name on a loan or a boat, you know, here it is. Hey, a nice, expensive boat, 5 years to pay. So, you know, you had to go out there and produce. So that's what I'm saying. It kind of shaped your mind that you got to make money in this fishery, too. You can't just know he's going to give you a free boat or free nets. Yeah.
How about, what's your sense of how boat ownership and being independent sort of shaped
things? Well, I think WACMA, Tunawak, what it did was helped people become independent fishermen, not married to a cannery that dictated when you fished, how much you're going to get for your fish, how much you could catch, that type of thing. And when Ofi and those people bought their boats, they became quasi-independent fishermen, and it helped in the negotiations of WACMA with companies, because if Mike's boat was company owned, and Ofi's boat was Ofi owned, Ofi could go fishing, where Mike, the company's say, are not fishing. Wackmon always stuck up for the locals. There was always negotiations going on with cannery superintendents. And, you know, at times, Wackmon went on strike in the name of conservation. Because remember that the Japanese decimated our runs here. And the canneries that were coming up, they wanted a pack. They didn't care about next year. They wanted a pack this year. And usually they wanted more than they could get. But there was no conservation in the cannery's eyes. Mm. And I remember one time my dad was on the phone. And I was listening to him and he says, we need a strike this year. And I think he was talking to Joe Clark. And Joe Clark said something. He said, no, I agree with you. We're not going to get a better price. But we got to act like it's price. We got to put more fish up river. That way we'll be able to make more money sooner than what the canneries want. So Wackmon's played a lot of different roles in shaping Bristol Bay.
I have two quick questions. When was it that people started to first get concerned about getting more fish upriver, these conservation issues? Do you have a sense of when that began?
I just remember after Japanese decimated our runs in Bristol Bay. I remember Governor Egan coming out and telling the federal government they better do something about the Japanese on the high seas. And if the federal government didn't do anything, he was going to make state workers blocked the river systems in Bristol Bay. And he wanted the federal government to throw Japanese, get them away from the tidewaters of Bristol Bay.
So maybe we can go back to the start of some of these early organizations that really brought people together to, to advocate for region residents and watershed residents and their involvement in the fishery or other issues. Can you tell me about a little bit of the history of those organizations and how you, what role, if any, you played in them?
Well, I was just a member of WACMA. That was the only organization I belonged to. But my grandfather came up here in 1902, and he was the ninth member to sign up with the Alaska Fishermen's Union. Alaska Fishermen's Union that was based in San Francisco, I believe. And the members back then were different. They treated the local residents here different than the ones outside. You even had a letter on the boat that you stated that you were a resident. Yeah. And it was a lot different getting back to conservation. I think when we became a state and the locals had more to say was when we people back then started talking about conservation. How much escapement we got? How much can we catch? You know, had local biologists, advisory committees, and that was a big involvement for local people.
Mm. So how did WACMA get started here?
WACMA got started a year or two after we... after the Bay voted for power, 52-3 somewhere back there. And there was Harvey and Truman Emberg. And
Father Indell was involved in that,
Father
too.
Father Indell, yeah.
Kallenberg was involved in it.
Kallenberg, yeah. Yeah, it was... I'm sure the canneries back then didn't want to see it being organized because... if you got an organization that's locally made up of local participants, you know, most of them joined too. I think there was 350, 400 members of, like I said earlier, of WACMA. And Togiak signed up. It was a good organization.
How long did that organization last? When did that organization lose its power, so to speak?
I think it went out in the early 80s. There was a strike year, and that's the year that Bristol Bay, what was the name of that organization? Dean Paddock was in charge of that. And he says, we've got to look at this fishery a new way. market-driven and something like that, you know. All kinds of stuff we never heard before. And WACMA went out of business.
20 people went out and scabbed on us.
Yeah.
The local stayed ashore. All the outsiders went out and loaded their boats.
Yeah.
And we had a tough year that year. Well, we had a tough couple strikes. But it was pretty evident to us that the non-watershed residents, as we said, didn't care if they got paid a dime. They went fishing. And they went fishing on us several times. And that's when WACMA and AFMA, the Outsiders Union, started falling apart. And things changed very drastically.
It seemed like to me that one of the things that strike illustrated was you didn't need all these boats to harvest the fish. So those guys were getting rich, and the other people weren't. People sat on the beach.
So what do you think the biggest accomplishments of WACMA were over the course of its existence?
Getting people together. Getting 350 fishermen or 400 fishermen together and having a board of directors represent us. You know? We had respect. I don't think we had complete control, but everybody honored what the board said. Yeah.
Well, I think if I could say this too, is that this was the first time when the people got together and they were concerned about their resources and how to affect change in that resource, right? And the relationships, and that, to me, that sort of colored some of those early people, like your dad and you, Ophi, got involved with the land claims too. So you started working kind of an advocate for kind of the greater community, I guess you might say. So that sort of colored into or affected the land claims too, and other issues, right?
Well, we've always had strong leaders in Bristol Bay. Things were in the 30s, 40s, 50s, things were really tough around here. In the 60s, 70s, and 80s, things started changing. You know, in the 60s, we didn't have good communication. Telephones. Everybody talked on 2638. Once in a while, the phones would work. We had no TV. Even I'm much younger than Ophi, I remember, go get butter. You don't have to go reach in the salt tiers to get butter. Go get ribs for supper. Pork ribs, you go take them out of the salt bucket, the little tiers. A lot of us didn't have electricity until the 60s. You know, a lot of us didn't have running water, and a lot of us didn't have flush toilets in our original houses. And, you know, you ordered your grub one time a year. You didn't go to the store very much unless you had some income. Most people didn't have income. Most people worked in the cannery in the springtime. And in the wintertime, they'd draw unemployment. So there wasn't too many options. And when they formed the WACMA, it was a glimmer of hope. It was a, we got to find more opportunities for the watershed residents, because they are getting taken on every front. And, you know, we hired Truman Emberg as a general manager type thing, Truman Maxine Emberg. And they had a pretty rough road to hoe, them early guys on that board. Even getting the canneries to sit down and talk with them. There's a lot of times, if you're a WACMA representative and you went walking on like superintendent's property, he'd come down, you'd put out your hand, how you doing? He wouldn't shake your hand. He'd tell you to get the hell off his property. Then he'd call the other cannery soups and say, Mike Davis was here. I just threw his ass off my property. I hope you guys do the same thing. I mean, that's the way it was back then. When we went on strike, we weren't allowed to walk on Peter Pan Dock. You weren't allowed in the mess hall. You weren't allowed in the coffee shops. I mean, it was a whole different world than what you see today.
And did the work that happened with WACMA, do you think that translated to other issues like land claims and other work in the region?
Not necessarily so, because Ofi and my dad and them were working on land claims many years before we got to settlement.
Mm.
And networking with different regions.
Mm.
Did WACMA and our involvement in the fisheries in negotiations help us, yeah, in land claims? I think it did. Because we had a team that negotiated, and that team kind of went forward, you know. And we've never taken second fiddle in our estimation in the back seat. I mean, BBNA was formed by my father way back then, you know. And when the corporation came into being, you seen my father was the president. Ofi became president for 30 years or whatever it was. How many years you served on that board, Ofi? 40?
I mean, 39 years when I'm off.
39 years, I mean, you know. And we respect people like Ofi and my dad and Donald Nielsen for the stuff that they had to put up with in early years, mm-hmm. to get to where we are today. And has fisheries played a role in that? I think it has. You know. And we're still involved in fisheries. We have one of the most active advisory committees in the state of Alaska that operates under the Board of Fish. We've retained our Board of Fish seats since Herman Schroeder days, you know, which is since statehood. We basically had a person out of Bristol Bay represent us. So, with a lot of different problems today than what our people had before.
We'd be definitely good to speak to some of that. Maybe be even before we get there, you can each tell us a bit more about how you, since you've both been involved in so many different issues in this region over the years, involving fisheries and other resources, what really motivated your getting involved in that way, stepping up to the helm for 39 years, for example? Could you maybe speak first to that before we go to some of these other questions?
Well, the canneries were kind of, they didn't allow much visitors around the cannery. They wanted their own fishermen and own employees. I remember in 61, I went to Igigig early, and we tied up by a cannery down there. And some of these canneries had what they call a fish boss or a dock boss, fish boss. And we tied up at the dock, and a guy hollered down, "Who are you a fish for?" "Columbia Ward." "Get the hell out. Go across the river." You know, they didn't want any other company's boats by their dock or walking around their cannery. But I think being a board of directors for WACMA, which I never was, but gave the board a good experience. You know, they were negotiating with Nick Bez. Nick Bez was one of the largest operators of salmon in the state, and Brindle, A.W. Brindle, he owned canneries from here to Ketchikan, and these guys had to negotiate with these guys for fish prices. And having that experience, I think, was a great experience for later years to come. I'm talking about Bristol Bay Native Association and a Native Corporation and stuff like that. And I remember in 60, about a year or two after BBNA was formed, my aunt called me. She said, "You want to get interested in land claims?" I said, "Nah, I got my family." She says, "Yeah, it's going to be big someday." And so I went to the meeting in the fire hall. Lots of people in there. Twin Hills, Naknek, Chicknick, all over. Usually have a 2-3 day meeting back then. And this was about 3-4 years before land claim started. I mean, it was settled. And they gave us reports about going to Washington, D.C. and negotiating, you know, what they wanted in the act. All the bad congressmen and all the good ones that would listen to them. And that was interesting. And then I went to a couple of meetings here, and then I moved up to Kalinganek, and I was up there for 6 years from 1970. And people up there said, "Yo, go to AFN. "No, I don't want to go AFN. "Yeah, nobody else want to go. You better go." So me and Georgie went. That was the first AFN when they voted for land claims. I forget the name of that place out there, Methodist University. And the place was packed. If you got a Ween ticket, there was a brand new hotel downtown. You could get a hotel room for $7. $7 if you showed your Ween ticket. Lots of free coffee. And the room was smoky. A lot of people there, this L-shaped. And they voted. It wasn't unanimous. I think Arctic Slope voted against it. Yeah. And we came home after a couple of days, and things were quiet for a while, and then BBNC was organized here. And then the village corporations. Yeah. A lot of history.
Mm-hmm.
I remember walking into a restaurant, me and Georgie, in Anchorage in 1971, 2 days before Christmas. Wanted something to eat. Packed restaurant. We were hungry. We wanted to get something to eat. And walked in, and right next there was a couple of guys staying there. And I heard them say, "I wonder what these guys are going to do with all the money. It's going to be gone, and then the land." I never paid much attention to them. I didn't want to start anything, my argument. It turned out different. I don't think BBNC lost 1 acre of land, Angst of land anyway, or the village corporation. Yeah. It was struggle in them early years for Bristol Bay, though. What did we know about investments? We had to help the village corporation select land. We had to work with the BIA on stockholders signing up. That was a 2-year project before we could even have an annual meeting. And how many shareholders did we know of who was going to be shareholders? So the accounting department or a board at that time issued more shares than what was the original 5,300 shareholders. And we wound up with 5,300 and some shareholders. There's some at-large shareholders, too. And BBNC was required to, in the act, help the village corporation select the land. Mm-hmm. Our land department was pretty busy. Plus, Harvey said, "We got to make money." So we had to look at investments back then too. You know, what did we know? We didn't know about pro forma and all that stuff. We bought the first major investment we bought was Peter Pan Seafoods, 1975. $9 million. Oh, we thought that was a good investment. The price was right. It wasn't too big amount for Bristol Bay. But what did we know about financing and about tendering and about, you know? Of course, that was a management deal, but 4 years later, we sold it for $23.5 million to the Japanese. Oh, I was upset when we had to sell. Oh. What? 22% interest rate, a couple of botulism cases, and just wasn't making money. Yeah.
So you take me, and you go ahead 20 years to MoFi, and I was in a geek, and I probably went to the same cannery as MoFi did, and I wanted to go to that cannery to take a Mackay. And I got up on top of the ladder, not off the ladder, I just got onto the top of the ladder. And the fish boss, our cannery superintendent, was standing there and said, "Who do you fish for? And where are you from?" I said, "I fish for CWF Eacock. And I'm from Dillingham." "Liar! Get out of here!" I don't know if it was the same guy or not. Right. We left to compare names.
Italian guy.
But I got thrown off of that dock and I had to untie and go away. And that was in the mid-80s. Mid-80s.
And how did you get so involved in region politics, Robin?
That's all there was at my dad's table as a young kid growing up. When he was sober, drinking coffee in the morning, or when he was partying that night, it was fish politics, native politics, fish politics, native politics, native politics, fish politics. And that's all I listened to. And as a young kid, he told me, I'm his only son, and I got a sister, you know, and right across our street was the Luckers family, seven boys there. And right on my right side, living was the Goulias, and there's five boys there. And I used to get the shit kicked out of me all the time, either by the Luckers or the Goulias, and I'd come crying home. Dad would say, "Grab a 2x4, get a piece of birch, don't come home crying to me." So I was a fighter from early on. It was survival mode, I mean. And all through high school, 9th, 10th grade, I mean, I was getting spankings in high school. They were designing new paddles to spank because I wouldn't listen to teachers. I'd argue with teachers. I remember when Hickel was first coming to Dillingham and he was going to address school, I wanted to do a big demonstration against him. I mean, I was politically active where people weren't here, you know. And I was going to get expelled for a week from school if I pulled it off against Hickel, but it was just something that I did in my family, you know. And fishing, I grew up, never trust canneries, they will screw you, and they'll screw you when you're pewing the fish. We used to pew when we unloaded the boats. You'd have a guy there with a count. And every fisherman knew that guy that was counting didn't count every fish. Mm. And if you had two fish on a pew, you'd holler two. But no, my family was involved in it, and so I got involved real early.
And you mentioned earlier that the issues that this region faces today are different. How so? And what are the big issues today? And how do those relate to those in the past?
Well, back then we didn't operate on what a bank said, on what a lending institution says. Last night I heard of a new boat down in the boat harbor. It's $535,000. I don't think there's one of us in this room, maybe Mike Davis, since he's a professor, could afford that kind of note at a bank. I mean, you put 10% down, you know, $53,000 down, and float a note. Yeah, I mean, Christ, who could afford? Just running a boat, it cost me around $15,000 to turn that key on in a boat. That's insurance, grub, and all that kind of stuff. And with these new boats, I mean, $535,000 boat, there's not many people that will survive. There's nobody that could buy a permit and buy that kind of boat and make it economical fishing. Nobody. Look at this year. I mean, you know, for boats around $100,000, $150,000, $180,000, you can. But our boats have developed so much, our nets have developed so much, and our ability to harvest fish now is so great. I mean, there was just a couple of years ago, we were harvesting like 3.5 million fish a day in Bristol Bay. Eek was hitting. Naknek was hitting, and we were hitting on a nush. And, you know, my boat is, I'm sure you've seen it in my yard, big aluminum boat, 25,000 pounds. I don't even put scuppers in, you know. Where 25,000 pounds in the 70s, there was no boat around that could hold that much. Hopefully, I can't remember any. Maybe Thunder Chief, but... I was a big old fiberglass boat, but today, a lot of boats.
Too many.
You know, high capacity. And we have, when my wife and I were first married, it was her and I fishing a boat. There was only two of you on a boat. There was no three, four people on a boat. But as outsiders bought limited entry permits, they got more crewmen, you had to put more crewmen on to process your fish in the back of the boat faster. And now you're seeing three, four people on the boat. You know. But fisheries really changed from even the 70s to now. Big changes. And the openings, I mean, we used to have a king opening on 9 a.m. Monday and shut down at 9 a.m. Saturday morning. You know, all week, fish kings. Now, we don't even get a king opening. If we do, it's 3-4 hours. Our salmon openings, sockeye salmon openings, are on the ebb. We never used to have ebb openings. Mm. We always opened half tide, took part of the flood, and then part of the ebb. It's changed. We've got an allocation in place now that between the drifters and set netters.
And what about how the organizing works around these issues?
What do you mean organizing?
Like the political work that's involved in trying to
that's
look out for...
That's all done in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
And right up until we go fishing, trying to influence him on fishing game to do the right thing, mm-hmm. you know. And then you hope he does it. That's about all you could do. I write a lot of letters and emails to commissioners and directors of fish and game on the fishery.
Robin, how did you know, when you just recently retired working for BBEDC, and you as the person that was in charge there, you also were running a fish processor too. So, mm-hmm. I mean, how did that change your perspective on some of these issues, or what insights did you have by being not on the other side, but also sort of taking on that role as well? What perspective did you sort of get from
when we bought it? The price, a year after we bought it, the price dropped 40 cents a pound for Bristol Bay sockeye.
Year after we bought it.
The return on investment was terrible. I put a committee together to look at how we could extract more capital out of the company. And if that meant changing product lines, we're going to change product lines. If that meant dismissing employees that have been there for 30 years and they don't want to change, that meant dismissing these employees. My goal at that time, which I told the board of directors, is I want to be the first company to break a dollar a pound. And we reached that goal. We're the first company in Bristol Bay to say the price will be $1.05 or whatever it was that year. The company, I'm the chairman of the board of Ocean Beauty, but I don't have a day-to-day influence or call upon myself within the company. We have a management team that's put together. And the management team meets about every 3 months. But we had a number of strategic planning sessions at things that the three of us watershed residents that sit on that board with three of their people, we had a number of problems with the way the company is operating, and we went through each one and did the due diligence to see how we can make the company better, how we can give more money to the fishermen by breaking the dollar a pound, and it's worked out pretty good. No. You know, last year your price of red salmon was going for about between 256 and 280 a pound, and now it's up into $4. It's 450, 475 a pound.
The wholesale price. You
know. The wholesale price right now. I got that this morning. Not too many buyers stepping forward right now. Everybody pretty much realizes that the price is paid to fishermen is a kind of an arbitrary price because of Silver Bay Seafoods going into Naknek. And the companies that are sitting around Bristol Bay right now don't want to lose their good fishermen. So they came up with $1.50 a pound, and I think you'll see another 10 cents above the $1.50, plus 10 to 12 cents for an RSW.
5 cents more for bleeding.
And 5 cents more for bleeding. Right now, I think the leader folks that bled iced, they're at $1.72 right now today.
Now, so Ofi, what about for you? What, and we can come back and both of you can reflect even more on this in terms of the issues that were most of concern and importance to people in the past involving resources. How does that relate to the ones that seem the most significant today?
Well, I think pre-WACMA days, we had the Alaska Fishermen's Union. I wasn't a member. I was too young. But to fish for a cannery, I believe I heard my father say, you had to be a member of that AFU. The outside agent, lower 48 agent, had a lot of clout with the superintendent. And when WACMA was formed, we had a bunch of members that they represented. And that one, our person, WACMA person, can go to a Nick Bez and said, look, I'm representing 350 fishermen or 400. That has a lot of clout. Nowadays, I think with a little card in your pocket, the limited entry, I think the future looks bright for some young person getting into the fishery here. Like Robin said, where are they going to get the cash for? I got two permits. Well, one is in my son's name. And I got one, but my little grandchild that you saw come in here, he's 13. Another year, maybe next year, he'll go on a boat if Eric doesn't fish the boat. But he'll eventually get my permit because where is he going to get $100,000 to buy a permit? And a minimum to be competitive out here, you need a $150,000 boat or more. Maybe $200,000 boat, RSW, jets on it, maybe high horsepower. how is that little guy going to be, where is he going to raise $300,000 in cash? He's going to be in debt the rest of his life. I look at it, I got into the fishery by working, maybe my age, back then. I don't know if I could compete with these guys now, because when I started fishing, it was 5 days a week. Then it was shortened to 4 days a week. And now it's hours. And you got to have six people on board. You see boats out here with six people. They don't stop. They're working in shifts. How could the local people compete with them? And they're putting in a lot of pounds, and you with a 2-3-man crew, you can't compete with them. They have a different perspective on this fishery than we do. The local people here want to make a good living out of it. You know, if they buy stove oil, if they buy groceries, maybe a new TV or a snowgo, they're happy. The snowgo could provide them caribou hunting, moose hunting, a lunch gift. A lunch gift, when they first came here, they were $800. Now, somebody said over $6,000 for an empty skiff, lunch skiff. The cost of living has gone up. And to me, I'd rather give my permit to my grandkids or my kids and sell it.
So what are some thoughts?
And another thing.
Go on, yeah.
Pre-statehood here, the fish commissioner, I don't know where he come from. I think on certain occasions they hired a local. Pete Fenner was one of them. He was the last fish commissioner I could remember. But most of the time they're in Seattle or wherever. And how are, in the wintertime, how is people going to communicate with them? You didn't know nothing about the fishery until in the spring when they had an AFU meeting, which was you were required to go. And they had a meeting. Oh, we're going to have a union meeting today. A union agent would get up and explain some things. But now, locally, we have an advisory committee. We got local biologists. We got state people. Our representatives in Juneau, they're willing to listen to us, you know, and if we have the right governor, he'll listen to us too. But there are a drastic change from years ago, a real big change. You don't realize it until you lived it. You know, and there was no such thing as breakfast in or lunch in Iqaluit. If you left here with a skiff at 9, 10 o'clock in the morning, you could have lunch in Iqaluit and a steam bath in Kalinginik. It took 5 days to get up there with a loaded boat. 5 days. Wow. You know, I had most of the time a conversion or a slow, big, wide slab wooden skiff with a 9-horse Johnson. You know, you memorize the leaves when you're going by. Nowadays, everybody wants speed. And that the fishery, same way. You jump on an airplane here, you want to be in Anchorage in an hour on a jet. Red Flensburg was one of the early air taxis here in the 1930s. He came here, he used to work for Boeing. He was a Swede. That guy could build airplanes. He told the local people here, he says, one of these years you're going to make Seattle in one day. Oh, you're crazy. He said, people, they ain't going to be that fast. Look what we got now. Robin could leave here 9 o'clock in the morning and have supper in Seattle.
A little Sunday.
Yeah. But I used exactly to, right. when I was president of BBNC, I'd leave here at 9:30 in the morning, and 5 o'clock I was in Seattle. But that's the way things are changing now. And I think anybody who keeps their permit for their kids has got a golden opportunity here. A golden opportunity. If you do it the right way.
You guys covered a lot of ground here today, so I don't know if you're running out of gas or not, but I mean, you covered a lot of ground here. Karen, maybe you should ask if they have anything else they want to say, but it's probably...
Yeah. Well,
You want these guys to fall over and start snoring on you, so...
Exactly. Well, I had one more quick question, and then maybe we could just open it up to anything else you feel like didn't get said. That's okay. We have the time. But one is just, you know, sort of in closing, at least for today, from all of the political work you've done over the years on behalf of two of region residents and the resources here, what do you feel like is something that you've learned that might be useful to tell young people today who are, you know, trying to respond to different sort of resource development issues here or concerns about the fisheries or other things? Are there things that you feel like you've learned from all your work that you feel like other people should know?
There's a couple of things I think that I'm happy to, that I was involved in when I was on the Fish and Game Advisory Committee here and preaching the sermon to local people. Two things that we should retain into the future that we can have control over this fishery. And it's obvious, you can see it. There's the 48-hour notice, I think that was started in the 50s. I think WACMA had a big play in that years ago, because the boats used to run between here and Naknek in them poor seasons, and they'd get the gravy in both areas. But the 48-hour notice was put in. You could transfer. And the 32-foot.
And if you took the 48 hours, it'd kill it for the locals. It could kill it for the locals. I mean, how long does it take to go from the bell buoy out here to Johnson Hill? Slack water, it don't take very long. Or run across the Igigig and get the gravy and then come back. That's the way it was in the 50s, I remember. Because my uncles used to travel. They were fishing for Ecock. Libby, McNeil, and Libby. And they'd fish here a day and then go to Naknek. It was 2 days a week, I think, back then. But that would be, for the future, I sure hope the people that never vote for that.
What about for you, Robin? What would be something that you've learned that you feel like would be useful?
Kids are so different today than when I was their age. I mean, you can't even compare it. I mean, the electronics, the communications that they have today, where we dreamed about, we didn't even dream about them because they were so far, what they've got today is so far advanced to what I was when I was a kid. But, you know, failure is going to be high. But what I tell young kids that come into BBDC up there, you know, and go forward, and if you fail, you know, take a step back, see where your wrongs were, and then go forward again. Don't give up the ship. More and more, I'm seeing more and more of our young kids stepping up, going out for an education. I mean, when I graduated from school, I didn't want to go to college. I wanted to be a fisherman. I want to be a trapper. My father made me go to college, and I thought that was the most stupidest thing he could have ever done for me. And that was the mindset back in them days. But today, you need a good education, and I told my boy that he'd get my permit if he graduated from college. If he didn't, I'll sell it to somebody else. He's not going to get my permit. And he earned my permit by getting an engineering degree from college. And I know that he will be able to come here and fish because of his full-time engineering job. He could have a bad season. He could have a good season. He doesn't have to rely on this money. If he has a good season, I know that Bristol Bay will pay for his kids' college education, just like it paid for my daughter's and my son's education. But too many times our people in Bristol Bay, they fail and they kind of get in a rut and reel back. And failure shouldn't be something that you reel back on. You should learn from whatever the failures are and try to overcome them and move on. And I'm seeing more and more younger kids step up to the plate. And I've seen fathers bring sons into BBDC to buy a limited entry permit.
And we pay damn near half the limited entry permit right now. We give them low interest rates. A lot of kids, I've seen two fathers, their sons are good fishermen, and they've come of age to have a permit. And their dad wants them to get a permit, and they won't sign the papers. Alice had the papers all filled out. And, you know, if it's 100,000, let's say 100,000, it's only 50,000 to them. And one of the dads was even going to back up the kid as a backup signature. So if the loan failed, it wasn't the kid we went after, it was the father we went after. But I'm kind of concerned. I don't see as many young people getting into the drift fishery. Set net fishery, yeah. But drift fishery seems to be not as many as I'd like to see getting into drift fishery. Because we need to do about 40 permits a year to change this trend around where watershed residents are on most of their permits. I'm very concerned about the budgets for out here from the state of Alaska. The state of Alaska hasn't put money in Bristol Bay's fisheries. We generate our own monies. We're supplying money to Kuskokwim. We're supplying money to Yukon. We're supplying money to Norton Sound out of Bristol Bay's funds. I see a lot of the programs that kept this run alive and well through good management, state management. Budget cuts are happening, and I'm afraid that a lot of our managers throughout the region don't have the necessary tools to conduct good biology and keep this run healthy. You look at this year, they didn't even know there was fish out there when he opened it, and the whole bay was full of fish. I mean, if you missed them first 3-4 days of fishing, you shouldn't even launch your boat this year. You know? And I'm a little concerned about what the state is doing in as far as investment in Bristol Bay.
Well, you know, you take a look at Eacock Beach, which has been a gold mine for the fishery, for the people that are set netting there. One of the best spots to own a set net site. You could literally fish with your slippers on down there. When I fished at Eacock in 61, 62, it was residents from Kaliganik. Some of them are still fishing. Stuyahuk, Portage Creek, Dillingham, Eacock. I know one old lady who had the number one site down there. I don't know what the status of it is now, but if you go down there today, you're going to see one person own 5 sites, another person own 3 sites, multiple sites. You can in the fishery, but they changed the law on permits, I guess, last year. But it's a sad case when that was a gold mine. Local people participated, and now very few. Like I said, if a young person wants to get into this fishery, he's going to need a lot of cash. That's why I want to pass mine on to my grandchildren. But look at all these programs. Robin mentioned a few, but there's more than what Robin mentioned. There's a scholarship program at BBNA, BBNC. BBDC's got a wonderful permit brokerage that they pay for some of the permit. But you got to have the ambition and initiative to wake up. These are good programs. Put all these... I'm glad that I had a... on the scholarships education at BBNC. I used to be on the board of BBNA. I'm glad that I participated and had a chance to vote for those programs. And there's so many programs that the young people, but there's a different lifestyle between the young people and ours today. First of all, a young person goes to college, graduates, meets all his friends there. He's going to stick around there for a few years, maybe get a job, or get a job in Anchorage or wherever, because we don't have the jobs here for them. You know, how many of our kids go to, going to have a state job, a biologist or whatever? How many kids can, some of them are getting teacher degrees, but not as many as we like to see. So they got a whole different lifestyle. Maybe they went to law school. How many can they make a living as a lawyer here? I don't know. They have a different outlook on life than we did, you know. I remember fishing in an open skiff when we got tired. We went to the mouth of Queen Slough and covered ourselves in a old tarpaulin that smelled to high hell. And we didn't mind it. We didn't know we were going to elevate up to a boat one of these days and have the comforts. But you think these young kids would do that now? I don't think so. May, you know, for 1 month, they can fishing out here. And on the good years, they make pretty good, but you got to be prepared to take your lumps if you're in the fishing business. It's a roller coaster. And that's the way I remember it for the last 60-some years. It's up and down. The runs are not going to be 40 million every year. They're going to be down like this year and even less. You know, BBNC is doing a survey. I think the survey is over now. Whether we should enroll these young people. But I'm getting more and more skeptical about supporting that program because, like I say, a kid goes to California, goes to college, and what the hell does he care about the land or land claims as long as he gets his check? So they could be a voting block that votes against us old-timers to sell the land. And then what the hell would be in? So I'm getting kind of skeptical about supporting that. I haven't made my mind up yet, but I'm real concerned that could happen down the future. They if we enroll enough of them, they could outvote us here.
You know, when both and I were younger, that's all we had was a compass and a boat. Mm. If you're lucky and really got the electronics, you got a fatometer. Compared to today, I hear on the radio, I'm going to Dillingham because my GPS is out. They got a fish with a GPS where before we'd watch the currents and the tides. I mean, I remember when I was 17 going down Igikin fishing. And I think I seen land one time because it was foggy and rough. And I never went up to the village. We went up to Naknek with a compass in the fog. I thought I was going to drown. I didn't know where I was. It was unreal. But we had a compass and we had a fathometer. As long as that fathometer stayed about 6-7 feet of water, we were happy. But today, it's completely different.
We had a cousin that fished a 22, 24-foot skiff. He's dead now. But he was a tough fisherman, fishing a skiff. He'd get a load of fish. He'd go to the mouth of Queen Slough, pew him up in the grass, go get another load, come back, or deliver that load, and then go back in the grass and pew that fish in. How the hell he do it? But hey, he didn't know any better. That's, you had to do it.
Yeah.
On a 24-hour opener, you got to put in all the fish you can. Eddie.
Yeah.
Was that Nicholson?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay,
Okay.
Good enough for today.
Good enough for today.
Okay, Karen.
Thank you both very much.